So, well, many thanks for that introduction to myself, and it's a very real pleasure to be invited to attend this meeting at KITP in Santa Barbara. And I'm sort of giving the first talk on the gravitational lensing, perhaps ironically, because I think I study gravitational lensing the least of anybody in this school. But I'm particularly interested in using nature's own telescope, that is the lensing effect of foreground galaxies, dark matter clumps, to amplify the faint background galaxies. My specialism is in finding very distant galaxies, that is galaxies at extremely high redshift, close to the dawn of time, and trying to understand their physical properties. Gravitational lensing is a key tool in enhancing our capabilities to do that. So in the background is a very beautiful HST composite color picture of a rich local cluster. This is Abel 2390. And this is just to give you a flavor that you can see these extended arcs. These, it's believed, and in many cases it's been shown, are actually images of galaxies much beyond the foreground cluster. The foreground cluster, in this case, about redshift 0.2, which is our own backyard by astronomical standards. These things here, in particular, this one is a redshift 4. This is seen almost within the first giga-year after the Big Bang. And the reason why they're extended is, of course, the lensing amplification tends to have this stretching effect. Here's another one I'll talk about later as well. So lensing, the focusing of light through the dark matter halos, greatly enhances the flux. In fact, as you all know from the lens equation, surface brightness is conserved, but the images become extended, so you get far more flux for your money. And of course, being astronomers, chasing the faintest objects, some of the faintest objects yet recorded, this enables you to probe intrinsically fainter luminosities and enables you to work down the luminosity function and address things like the importance of dwarf galaxies. So I'm going to actually focus on four case studies, each illustrating a different aspect of the utility of gravitational lensing in studying different objects. So I'll start off with a study that I undertook with my very own Alexei Mostakis a few years ago, and Mark Davis at Berkeley. And this was to study one of the galaxies in this previous transparency overhead. And it's this system of arcs here in the cluster Abel 2390. Now, Tom Broadlift, Brendan Fry showed through spectroscopy using the Keck telescope that in fact this had a spectrum consistent with being at a redshift 4 based on Lyman alpha in emission. I'll talk more about Lyman alpha later on. So showing that this in fact was at the time the second highest redshift normal galaxy known.
What is arc A
redshift? I'll talk about this later. This is a redshift 4 system. This is the redshift 4 I'm talking about. And Lexi and I were intrigued by the system because, of course, if you saw the whole space telescope resolution, this is really stretched out. In fact, it's many resolution elements. I cited extends over 5 arc seconds or so, with another arc, of course, below extending over 3 arc seconds. Even from the ground, where the typical seeing is half an arc second, 1 arc second. Signatures of differences within that distant galaxy. Bear in mind, without the lensing amplification, this would probably be a point source. All the light would be coming apparently from the same area. There would be no scope for spatially resolved studies. What we would like to do.
Okay. Is that better or worse?
No, it's just for recording you.
Oh gosh, yeah. I'm afraid you have to talk to my agent.
All your competitors can do that.
So we thought we would look for spatially resolved information. Specifically, of course, we know local galaxies have large colour gradients. They have very mixed stellar populations. If you look at our own Milky Way, the bulge is rather old, the stars are rather red and of lower metallicity. In the spiral arms, the stars are predominantly young, there is active star formation, they're slightly more metal rich. Can we see exactly that same signature at high redshift? If we can, then it's telling us something fundamental about galaxy formation. I mean, the paradigm is that galaxies, massive galaxies such as our own, assemble over cosmic time through mergers of smaller subunits. We really want to know at a redshift of 4, when the universe was of the order of only a billion years old, whether there had been previous action such that you could have a differentiation of populations. There were areas with older stars, areas with younger stars, or whether these were the primeval subunits that we see. Now, one of the useful tools we have in astronomy is simply the ability to put in different filters in our cameras and ask a very simple question, is something red or is something blue? Now, we know from stellar population synthesis models that if you have an old stellar population, this will intrinsically have red colours. This is simply because when you make stars, they're not like cars, you don't make all of one shape and size, you make a range according to the initial mass function. The most massive stars burn brightest, burn hottest and bluest, and they're the shortest lived. So if you have a stellar population that's formed many hundreds of mega years previously, in fact all these things will long since have exploded and the population will appear red. A blue population is predominantly young. There is some confusion, of course, because of the nuisance effect of dusk reddening. But here I show a little toy diagram we put in our paper a few years ago. Of course, this has been known for many, many years, showing an evolved stellar population. This is a spectrum. And you see here a characteristic break around 4,000 angstroms, the 4,000 angstrom break. This is a combination of absorption by things like calcium, calcium ions in the atmospheres of cooler stars, and also the Balmer break predominantly in A stars. So you can see we have a break signature, so if we're able to monitor the light below the break and above the break, this break could be a signature of old starlight. And in fact, we looked for exactly that. Inspired by the HST images, we took high-resolution ground-based Keck images with the NERC camera, specifically in the H band, that's about 1.5 microns, and in the K, it's around 2 microns. You can see just about these dotted lines. They bracket very nicely this break. So you're able to detect color gradients if they exist across the galaxy, and with, you know, some degree of uncertainty depending on the initial mass function, the exact star formation history and the presence of dust, you can recover whether this galaxy also has age gradients across it. Are there regions with young stars? Are there regions with old stars? Without the benefit of gravitational lensing, this would be impossible. And in fact, we're able to map exactly that, and we were able to discover that indeed there were regions of this galaxy that had stars on average that were older than 100 mega years, and regions that had sites of active star formation as well. So this galaxy presumably had a complicated history, and you know, for the first time really at redshift 4 and beyond, we were able to do a detailed case study using the spatial resolution afforded by gravitational lensing.
Wouldn't you expect perhaps in the high redshift galaxy like this lots of clumpy dust?
Absolutely, yeah. But you're able to break that degeneracy at some level because not only do we have the H and the K, we also have filters in the UV. So, yeah, we looked at that in some detail. It is a concern. It is an uncertainty. We're able to combat it at some level.
What's the intrinsic scale size of the system?
It's about 1 kiloparsec. So,
very small galaxy.
Yeah. So the lensing extends it by a factor of about 20, I believe. Yeah. So the fun doesn't stop there, of course, because you will notice, as I've mentioned repeatedly, the arcs are quite linear structures. So we can use another tool in the astronomer's armoury, which is spectroscopy, and put a long slit along the galaxy, which is exactly what we did. This is following up the work of Fry and Broadhurst. We're trying to do spatially resolved spectroscopy along it. So what we see here is we have wavelength going along here. This is our actual spectrum. This is the HST image, so the spatial dimension along here, this is the image, this is where the slit fell, and this is a smooth version of the image just to bring out some of the structure. What I've done just to make it easier on the eye is I've subtracted that massive elliptical to do with the cluster out, you can see a bit of noise from that subtraction there. And to do that, just to make it easier on the eye, this is the spectrum of the lensing elliptical. So what's interesting to note, and I've zoomed in here on a region of line emission, Lyman alpha. Lyman alpha, of course, is the strongest emission line from hydrogen. You can ask, well, why is hydrogen emitting at all? This is presumably due to star formation, as I mentioned. The youngest, hottest, shortest-lived stars shine bluest. They actually generate ionizing photons. If you have neutral gas around it, you get recombinations, you get the Lyman alpha line. And you can see this. What's very interesting, and what puzzled us when we first discovered this, you can see essentially the continuum seen in the HST images. Look where the line emission falls. It doesn't fall anywhere near the continuum, it's spatially offset. So this initially was quite a puzzle to us. We didn't expect that. You can imagine that had we just taken a spectrum of this bit, we actually saw stellar absorption features and continuum, as you would expect, but we saw no line emission, so we would have been fooled in our interpretation somewhat. We believe these line emission Lyman alpha regions are sites of star formation, but they're spatially, the Lyman alpha emission is spatially offset from the continuum, which would seem odd. One would think that the continuum is the star formation. It probably is. Part of the explanation we advanced was that, in fact, Lyman alpha has a very grim time getting out of galaxies. It is a resonant line, of course. Its scattering cross-section is very high. It essentially plays cosmic pinball getting out of a galaxy. Wherever it encounters neutral hydrogen, its scattering cross-section is enormously high. It's absorbed, re-emitted, it random walks out. So you can imagine, perhaps, that the line of sight towards here would have perhaps a high cross-section, absorption cross-section for Lyman alpha, but you might have some sort of extragalactic neutral H1 mirrors bouncing that light into our line of sight. Yep.
So are your numbers for the efficiency of the Lyman alpha emission getting out of galaxies consistent with, say, the differences observed between submillimeter sources
yeah.
and Lyman alpha detected galaxies? Is that all hanging together?
No, it's a very good question, because most of the work on Lyman alpha emission from, say, the Lyman break galaxies is done using, you know, very small slits. So the worry is, if this is generically true and they target the slits on the continuum, then you miss some fraction of Lyman alpha emission if it's scattered out into a more diffuse halo, for example. So a technique called integral field spectroscopy, I'll come on to later, might address this somewhat. Okay. And just in passing on this, what Lexi and I have done for this plot is to collapse the whole spectrum all the way along, including the Lyman alpha emission. And interestingly, you see, of course, the Lyman alpha emission, and for the people who are familiar with high redshift line emission, you'll see the intrinsic red wing asymmetry, very sharp cutoff on the blue side. This is supposedly due to the fact we're just seeing the light back scattered off the far side of the nebula. The near side is all mopped up by a combination of gas within its galaxy and the intergalactic medium below. And in fact, you can see that because you can see essentially a damp Lyman alpha absorption system absorbing the blue wing, and this absorption system coming from the continuum emission there. So it's quite a neat illustration, encapsulated with just one source of various aspects that have been bothering high redshift astronomers for a number of years. And I'm not saying this is solving any significant fraction of that, but it's just an interesting case study, and it shows through lensing that we can get to the heart of the matter. We've discovered colour gradients within a galaxy indicative of a more complicated star formation history within a giga-year or so of the Big Bang. We've discovered spatially offset Lyman alpha emission, which calls into question some of the work on the distribution of equivalent widths of Lyman alpha emission in star-forming galaxies at a high redshift, if there is an extended halo that people are missing through spectroscopy.
Andy, I get confused with parity in this cluster. Which knots match the matter?
I think the parity is flipped on this. Now, you notice I've labelled 1 to 4 and 1 to 3. Yeah. In fact, one of the knots here has structure, and it's believed that they're images of each other.
So that means your Lyman alpha emitting regions are not multiple images of each other?
Yeah,
they are. No. I mean, these are not fault across the... I mean, these are not fault because there's the galaxy in between, right?
Right.
It's like if you move the source, you move both opposite mean, they're pointing in the same direction.
So that's right. N4 and S1, which we might associate a little bit with the light dynamic.
Yeah, they're the same thing. Yeah. I should have been more careful on the labelling. I just pretty much wherever I saw a knot, I labelled it. Yeah. And,
So S1 does not go with N1?
No, that's right. Yeah. Sorry, apologies for that. Yeah.
Okay, but I'm sorry. A little confused then. So some fraction of these knots, these knots that you see optically, but others do not?
No. Only potentially S1, although statistically it's offset from it, and N4. And these are images of the same knot. Yeah. So you can see the lensing is larger in the northern arc. So you can see very clearly here, I've drawn a line through N4. It's the closest source of of continuum emission. Now, it's well separated, even with ground-based resolution.
Right, in the spectral other spectrum. Knots, N1, N2, N3.
They don't have associated line emission. They have continuum emission. And we're able to independently derive the redshift from stellar absorption lines into stellar features.
Is there anything unusual about S1 and N4?
No.
You've seen line emission there.
Yeah. It seems entirely random whether line emission gets out or not. So we see no reason. I mean, this is imaging in the observed optical residue of rest frame UV. These are picking up UV strong regions. These should be sites of star formation.
Right.
But we don't see Lyman alpha. But, you know, Lyman alpha gets out some small fraction of the time from these galaxies.
Does it make sense that S1 is quite a bit brighter than N4 in Lyman alpha?
That's probably due to the centering within the slit. You can see that's well centered. And then just because of the way it's slanted, we might be experiencing some slit losses on that. Yeah, I mean, it's something we worry about. And again, if you could hit this with an integral field unit, you'd be laughing. Okay.
And it's reasonable to suppose the line emission is also lensed in the spatial direction.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, again, this association of them, those two emission regions with N4 and S1 is just, okay, they're closest to those two knots, but
well, I mean,
do you know for a fact that that is not emission, for example, associated with stuff spewing from N1 or N2?
Well,
and just lighting up, I mean,
well, I mean, generically, the inventory of UV photons will be from the entire galaxy. Right. Now, it's just a proximity argument that that's the closest source. But, the calculation we do in the paper is how much UV emission is coming out in there, what, therefore, is the equivalent width of that Lyman alpha emission, what is the efficiency of reprocessing. So, you know, you can do a better study, but, you know, it's unclear whether it's the composite effect of all of these or simply this one. But if you argue that, you'd have to then argue that there would be some tunnel of low H1 density such that these photons, the ionizing photons, could get out to hit this external mirror.
We were just wondering whether you could detect, because there must be an image in between those two, right?
Underneath the galaxy. Yeah.
Yes. I think this has been seen, is that right? Yeah. Well, there's two other redshift 4 smaller images in this system. Yeah. Okay. So I've presented now a case study of redshift 4 object. Now, of course, you know, the biggest game in town in the high redshift world at the moment is finding even more high redshift objects. I mean, you know, it's sounds a bit pathetic, really, but it's all a big competition. So, can we use the advantage of gravitational lensing to find the most distant and possibly the faintest objects yet seen? So, before I go into that, I'll just give you a brief run through of the general techniques to find high redshift galaxies. Now, if you take a deep image of a portion of the night sky, for example, the Hubble Deep Field, or more recently the Ultra Deep Field, you get many hundreds of galaxies per square arc minute. And you can look at that, and there's a range of sizes, the range of apparent brightnesses. Now, of course, you just can't say, well, all the faint ones are far away, because they could be dwarf galaxies that are nearby. You do technique to separate the high redshift sheep from the low redshift goats. It's too expensive to go and take a spectrum of everything. So people a few years ago came up with the effectively poor man's spectroscopy called photometric redshifts. Instead of taking a nice spectrum where you have 1,000 resolution elements, such as the one I just showed you, you take 4 or 5 filters, you have 4 or 5 resolution elements. And as a characteristic spectrum of a galaxy, is redshift, it is stretched, different features appear in different wave bands, and you might be able to, you know, pick a target list that are more likely to be high redshift than low redshift. Now, an extension of this that revolutionized the field was Chuck Stardell in the mid-90s, and there had been previous work done by Gutha Carter, saying that you can use the universe itself as a filter, that in fact we've known for many decades, if you take a quasar spectrum, short of Lyman Alpha, the quasar rest grain, you see a picket fence-like structure, which in fact is the quasar light approaching us, but passing through clouds of neutral hydrogen, perhaps associated with galaxies, in some cases low column density systems, perhaps not. But of course, those galaxies will take their own tacks. They will preferentially absorb the photons tuned to Lyman Alpha at their own redshift, their own rest frame Lyman alpha wavelength, producing the Lyman alpha forest. The strength of absorption of this forest increases greatly as you go to higher redshift, and in fact by redshift of 3 it's a huge decrement below Lyman alpha. And when you get to redshift of 6, very important result in the last 5 years, in fact effectively there is no light left at all. It's the Gunn-Peterson effect. The universe is optically thick to light below Lyman alpha. Essentially the universe becomes one large damp Lyman alpha absorber. And Bob Becker and various others in collaboration with Fan discovered this in the Sloan quasars. It had been predicted in 1965. It took a mere 40 years to be discovered, the Gunn-Peterson effect. Redshift beyond 6, the universe becomes optically thick to Lyman alpha. So we can use this because if we pick a couple of filters, one above Lyman alpha at redshift of 6 and one below, it's a question of now you see it, now you don't. The shorter wavelengths should be invisible. So in fact my PhD student Elizabeth Stanway, we were amongst the first people to we were the first people to extend this technique that had been shown to be true for the Sloan quasars to galaxies using HST imaging, things like the Good Survey and then the Ultra Deep Field, imaging the same patch of sky repeatedly in the I filter and the Z filter, or the Z filter as you would say here. And of course, they're based on the Sloan filters, they have very, very sharp sides, that's important. Here is a cartoon of a redshift 6 galaxy spectrum. You can see maybe a little bit of a pickup of flux around Lyman beta, but essentially little or no flux short of Lyman alpha. And here is what you would expect the colours to be. So we are here at redshift 0, we're interested in here at redshift 5 and 6, and this is the colour. Here is neutral colours, and here are red colours. So essentially something that is red has a lot of flux in the Z filter and very little in the I. And you can see at redshifts beyond 5.5, this is the selection window. And here are a few templates of galaxies. So you can ask the question, if we simply pick red objects, what fraction of the time are we going to make fools of ourselves claiming these are the most distant objects yet? And the answer is, it's actually quite low. You can be fooled by very red galaxies, red because they're old, elliptical galaxies of redshift 1 to 2, the extremely red object population that I know some of you, including Alexei, have studied in great detail, and Tommaso as well with the evolved ellipticals. And you can be fooled by those low-mass T-dwarf stars within our own galaxy. Now, of course, low-mass stars are of great interest to lots of people, although not to me. And this is exactly what I was saying, that you know, in the long wavelength bands you can see it, and then this vanishes completely.
Yeah. So if you had one more filter, which one would you add to get rid of those?
You would move into the near infrared. So in fact we've done this, and to Spitzer as well. So
these are star-forming galaxies, so they should be flat.
Yeah.
Relatively flat in the UV.
Yeah.
While red galaxies are red all the way.
So we've already get rid of the stars.
So just to show you that this really is a needle in a haystack work. So there are 10,000 points here, okay? And this is going from bright to faint. Okay, and up here is, you know, neutral colours, red colours. So you can see there is a population that sits away from it. The ones I've circled, we believe, are genuinely high redshift galaxies. They're red, they're faint. These dots didn't stand up to closer inspection, but it seemed a relatively good way to potentially isolate some of the most distant galaxies yet found. I'll merge this into lensing in a moment, so don't get anxious. So just simply counting red dots in HST images, I mean, that's great fun, but we actually require a high level of scientific proof before we can claim that these are genuinely distant galaxies. So here was one of the first spectra that we took to confirm this population. So of course you should never believe a single line redshift unless you hear it from me. So this is Lyman Alpha redshift 6, redshifted to around 8300 angstroms, all the way across, starts in the rest UV, crosses the optical, it's now into the near infrared. The universe is stretched by a factor of 7. And here we see the 2D, this is the 1D. You notice maybe a little bit of structure in this line, a couple of different peaks. We believe that this it's not a doublet line, this is either velocity structure or maybe an absorbing cloud in the way. You can see the characteristic sharp blue cutoff that I showed you before. So interestingly, when we published this and we had another spectrum of a different galaxy in the same field, we showed this structure within the Lyman Alpha line. I had two emails on the same day, one from somebody saying this is great evidence for gaseous infall into primeval galaxies. Somebody else saying it was great evidence for outflow, but you know, the gas isn't staying still, that's for sure. So we can, of course, then apply this technique to gravitational lenses, primarily the very rich clusters that are known, both the Abel clusters in the local universe and now the beautiful clusters which are coming out through other surveys, including X-ray surveys, at higher redshift. And this cluster is 2218, which is a favourite of many of you here, I know. And what are drawn on here are the critical lines, such that this is the maximum lensing amplification you would get at a particular redshift. And of course, these lines move according to the redshift because of the lever arm effect and the lens geometry. So you could take very deep images using the Hubble Space Telescope, both using the ACS camera, which is the optical camera going out to about 1 micron, and then perhaps using NICMOS, which goes beyond that out to about 1.7 microns, and use exactly the same Lyman break technique to try and identify sources. These are star-forming galaxies because, of course, although you're looking in the infrared is actually the rest frame optical. They have to be UV bright, therefore star-forming. And many groups have been doing this, with you know, some modicum of success. So you can select your galaxies like that. There's another way you can do it, and I showed you how we first of all selected galaxies through photometric redshifts, the Lyman break technique, and then went to take spectra. Lensing gives you an added bonus because it focuses, clearly it focuses light, but it also focuses your attention on where you are most likely to find very distant galaxies. So you could cut out the middleman instead of imaging first. You could just simply put your long slit along a critical line, corresponding to a particular redshift, and disperse the light. This is a long slit spectrum, so the light gets dispersed out here. And look at the redshifts that the lens geometry predicts, you would see line emission. And if you have serendipitously a galaxy in the right place, then you might see this line emission without ever having seen it in imaging first of all. So many groups have been trying this, and a few years ago Mike Santos and Richard Ellis successfully applied this at redshift 5 to find some very nice, one case at least, a very nice Lyman alpha emitter through this blind survey, but not quite blind, of course, because you have the gravitational lensing information. In more recent years, a group, Rosa Peller, who will be attending in a few weeks' time, I think, have tried this, and Johan Richard and Jean-Paul Kneb have tried this, and have published a tentative redshift 10 object, which hasn't unfortunately stood the test of time. They have a number of other candidates which do look somewhat better. In fact, I think Graham Smith is also attending later on the meeting, and should ask Graham Smith because he did the follow-up work on this. People generally look for Lyman alpha, because Lyman alpha is supposed to be very strong in star-forming regions. And I've shown you that, in fact, we have many cases where Lyman alpha does get out. But I also mentioned Lyman alpha isn't a particularly good diagnostic, that it has a tough time getting out of galaxies. You can measure a Lyman alpha flux. It doesn't really tell you what the star formation rate is at all. It gives a lower limit on it. You don't know what the extinction factor is. And if you cast your mind back to something I said right at the beginning, that the universe actually becomes optically thick to Lyman alpha beyond a redshift of 6. So you might think, why are people wasting their time? Because we know Lyman alpha can't get to us. Well, in fact, there's many millions of pounds been spent on experiments to look for Lyman alpha beyond a redshift of 6. I think, you know, these stand probably a 50-50 chance of showing something. We know the universe is optically thick, but the hope is that these galaxies carve out their own H2 regions, and that by the time the photons have got through that Strömgren sphere, that they're no longer resonant. The expansion of the universe means that they're no longer preferentially absorbed by the intergalactic medium. That might sound a bit of a vain hope, but there's experiments underway now, including DAZL, a narrowband imager, to look for Lyman alpha redshift between 7 and 10, that's going on the Very Large Telescopes in Chile this December. So, what are the other options? We can look for continuum through imaging. We can look through Lyman alpha. That might or might not yield something. If it doesn't yield something, it's completely unclear whether the upper limits are of any interest at all. So how do we actually try and do some serious science, even with upper limits? One way is to look for longer rest frame wavelength lines, for example, H-alpha. Okay, so H-alpha rest frame wavelength, 6,500 angstroms in the R-band. And, of course, you know, at redshift 7 or 8 or 10, this appears in the near infrared. The near infrared is a complete nightmare from the ground. The sky is enormously bright. It's glowing, thermal radiation. You can do it from space with Spitzer. Spitzer is a wonderful telescope. In fact, some of the redshift 6 galaxies we found, we've continued the sort of work that I talked about that I did with Lexi, looking for evidence of old starlight, rather than do that at redshift 4, doing it at redshift 6. And we've had a couple of papers with my student Lawrence Arles on that. What about spectroscopy? Well, Spitzer has a spectrograph, the IRS, and yeah, not related here, this is quite a nice instrument, but it gets hard. I mean, Spitzer is the size of a garbage can lid. It's 85 centimeters across. It is cryogenically cooled, which helps. It's above the atmosphere, which helps greatly, but still, your resolution is not great. If you do the lambda over D calculation, and you're working at 5 microns and beyond, the resolution isn't great, the aperture isn't great, but you can do the experiment. You can put your slits down with the IRS and take spectra, and you're tuning the wavelength range to look for H-alpha at redshift 7 and beyond. And I've been doing this experiment in collaboration. And in fact, this experiment is led by my colleague Mark Lacey at Spitzer, and in collaboration with Harry Teplitz and Jean-Paul Kniebe. And we started this last year, and in fact, these are the preliminary results. This is kind of a busy diagram, so I'll tell you what's happening. This is what the raw data looked like. You know, everything you can see in this is detector artifacts and noise. Okay, but thanks to the miracle of data reduction, we can actually tidy this up somewhat. So these are essentially the pre-images. So we've imaged it to see what sources are there, and then we've taken a long-slit spectrum. So these are the pre-images, and then this is the long-slit spectrum. This is actually IRS works at two different wavelengths at once, showing contiguous regions of the sky. And we've now looked close to along the critical line at redshift 10 of Abel 2218. Now, this is the other way up from the other plot I showed, so wavelength increases along here. And then this is distance along the slit in this direction. Okay, you can see a nice bright galaxy nearby. You can even see an emission line from this galaxy where it brightens there. This, in fact, is what's called a PAH feature. This is typical of star-forming galaxies at modest redshift. This galaxy is a redshift of 0.1. Not particularly interesting. With a bit of massaging of the data, you see lots and lots of noise spikes, including a noise spike I've drawn a green circle around, because this noise spike, if we split the data up into two halves, of course most of these noise spikes don't reproduce as you would expect, this one does. It also appears not to be a detector artifact, it's not to do with a hot pixel, not to do with flat fielding, but it does appear to be real. Now, if you're courageous, as Mark Lacey was at the IAU last month, you say that we have a potential detection of Lyman alpha redshift 9.8. If you're more conservative... H alpha redshift 9.8. Okay? The feature is, admittedly, it's only 3 or 4 sigma, but it is consistent with being that. Clearly, we don't want to stick our necks out and publish this yet, so we're trying to get follow-up. We're trying to image deep to see whether we can recover something which has... a Lyman alpha break, consistent with being that redshift. We'll also try and get a Lyman alpha spectrum. Lyman alpha will be appear in the J band, so you need near infrared spectrographs like NIRSPEC on Keck. Now, an upper limit from Lyman alpha wouldn't necessarily rule it out, because of course Lyman alpha might not get out. We know H alpha does get out typically, Lyman alpha not always. But certainly if we saw Lyman alpha, it would be a pretty convincing detection of this.
So this is 2218?
There's 2218.
So you probably have plenty of images.
That's right. So we're trawling the archive. And in fact, of course, Richard Ellis and Dan Stark have been doing
J-band.
Unfortunately, we talked to them and they missed this bit. But Richard's a generous man, so maybe we'll get a NIRSPEC spectrum at some point.
Do they have all images? Do you see anything?
So we're looking into that now. Okay. Yeah. We need deeper images than have yet been taken.
How many exposures do you have? What's the chance of the cosmic rays in the same
spot? So it's 24-hour integration. They're split into a few minutes each. So in fact, the cosmic ray rejection is very good indeed. Yeah. The worry is that this is a detector artifact, but we've been looking into that. And of course, Mark Lacey is our Spitzer guru, and we're increasingly confident.
Sorry, I missed the first part of Leon's question. I mean, you would expect statistically that you expect a few noise spikes to be at the same position.
And this is what did for the Pello object initially. We've run statistical tests. You know, what is the chance of getting 2-3 sigma detections on top of each other in independent halves of the data? Given that the array is actually quite small, you can see the individual pixels there. It is statistically significant. Whether it's really redshift 10, we're not going to rush into print before we have.
What else could it be?
Well, I mean, we know that there are PAH features with emission lines and that wavelength. It would have to have, you know, the highest agreement width ever seen for these features, for example. It could be, you know, a passion line, perhaps, another line of hydrogen in a lower redshift galaxy.
But wouldn't you see other lines?
Not necessarily, because, you know, if it was something like passion alpha, then all the rest of that series are much fainter. I think the killer piece of circumstantial evidence is its position is close to the critical line for redshift 10.
That is the same as redshift 7.5.
Yeah. Right, but then, you know, the passion line is very different wavelength. So that would
rule. Passion alpha would be like a third of the redshift, right?
That's right. Yeah. Three. Yeah. Yeah. So that would rule that out.
It also depends on that you're on having a fairly accurate lens model.
Yeah, so Jean-Paul is adamant, but maybe I can talk to the leading experts here to see whether that is the case. Okay.
Well, 2218 has really good data on lots of arcs, So,
Tommaso, I've been going about half an hour. I've got some more material. I can either save this for a talk later or I can motor through it now.
Let's see what people think here.
Who's up for seeing the universe in 3D?
Yes, sir.
Okay, sure. I'll go through this rather quickly. So I alluded before to long slit spectroscopy and missing some information. So it would be marvellous if you were able, with a distant galaxy, perhaps a lensed arc, instead of putting your long slit along there, and of course in astronomy you use a long slit because the sky is bright, you want to get rid of a lot of that sky background to become sensitive, but you also then lose a lot of the information. Okay, you can see an example here, this is an HDF galaxy, you could imagine that being a lens, by long slit spectroscopy, you know, you'll get the redshift, but you're certainly not going to get the correct fluxes, and if there's a gradient in metallicity or reddening or whatever, you're going to miss that. So really what you want is to be able to take a spectrum at each point in over this two-dimensional area on the sky, and of course the active spectroscopy disperses your light, gives you a third dimension wavelength, and enables you to see this in three dimensions. And this is a technique called integral field spectroscopy. This has been around for a number of years now, and my team, when I was at Cambridge, did the first use of this on 8-meter telescopes, certainly in the infrared. And I've talked about the infrared repeatedly, and I said certainly the mid-infrared is just a nightmare from the ground. The near-infrared, I'm talking about perhaps 1 to 2 microns, you can do from the ground, but again, I know a lot of you have imaged deep in the K, and it's sort of a nightmare to get deep. And the H as well is particularly bright, the H being around 1.6 microns. In fact, if you do spectroscopy, some of that problem goes away, because a lot of that sky brightness isn't continuum emission from the sky, it's discrete night sky emission lines, which are basically unresolved at typical astronomical resolutions. So if you're able to disperse the light and work between the night sky lines, the sky is enormously dark. Nobody's got a good measure of how dark the sky is in the infrared, but it's probably darker than it is in the optical, okay? Because it's just Rayleigh scattering. Now, so if you're able to choose your redshifts wisely, such your emission lines appear between the night sky lines, you're going to disperse the light. You can get actually pretty acceptable sensitivities even in the infrared, okay? So we're talking at redshifts beyond 1, even in the absence of lensing, reaching star formation rates inferred from the line emission, like H alpha, gives you the UV photon budget. You assume an IMF, gives you the number of OB stars, that gives you the star formation rate, modulo all sorts of assumptions along the way that we won't bother with now. But according to, say, the Kennicott prescription, it gets you down to a solar mass per year routinely on an 8-meter class telescope in the infrared at redshifts beyond 1. That's very respectable. That's sub Milky Way star formation rates when the universe is less than 1/2 of its current age. So really this approach of spectroscopy is great, and this approach of spatially resolved spectroscopy is even better, because we're able to trace gradients in metallicity and reddening, we're able to trace rotation curves of galaxies. And of course with lensing, you're spreading the image out anyway, you don't really want to just put a long slit along there, you want all the information you can get. So this is the experiment that we have done. That's just to show you what the sky glow in the infrared looks like. So you imagine a broadband filter encompassing all that. You do IFU spectrum, you work between these skylines, they burn out 10-20% of the array, but the 80% of the rest of the time you get enormously faint. So we had a large project on the Gemini telescopes. So both the Gemini North telescope in Hawaii and its sister telescope, Gemini South in Chile. And on Gemini North, we used the GMOS integral field unit. GMOS works in the optical. And on the South, a spectrograph we built in Cambridge, led by Ian Parry, called SURPASS, the Cambridge Infrared Panoramic Survey Spectrograph. They're comparable. GMOS is slightly smaller. It's 5 by 7 arc seconds. This is 10 by 13 arc seconds.
Those are both Gemini South, I would guess.
GMOS now has a sister instrument
Yeah.
And is this others?
Both the fibers. Yeah, that's a good point. I'll talk about that in a moment. So one of the key science drivers, we had a large allocation thanks to Matt Mountain of Director's Discretionary Time to demonstrate, this is a number of years ago now, the advantages of using IFUs on 8-meter telescopes. So we had a dual program, both in the optical and in the infrared, and lensing was one of our key goals. So this again is everybody's favourite cluster, 2218. And this is a redshift 1 arc, in fact one of the first to be spectroscopically confirmed many years ago. And here is our IFU spectrum of it. Now, short of giving you those 3D glasses they get at cinemas, it's very difficult to visualise 3D data cubes. What we're actually seeing here is close to raw data. So these are skylines going here. So this is wavelength along the X and distance along the slit on the Y. But what's confusing here is, of course, it's a multi-fibre IFU. So in fact, you can imagine it's a matrix of fibres and they repeat every so often. So in fact, you can see there's two little dots progressing through. I don't know if you can see that. Yeah. That is oxygen 2 emission. It's another diagnostic star formation from this redshift 1 galaxy. Take a look at this night skyline. So this is fixed in wavelength. You can see, looking from the bottom to the top, that that oxygen 2 doublet shifts away from the skyline. And those of you, I know a lot of you do spectroscopy, so you'll remember that the oxygen 2 doublet is split by about 220 kilometers per second. So you can just, by eye, see that you have a velocity gradient of the order of 200 kilometers per second that you've detected in this galaxy. Okay? So essentially you've mapped a rotation curve in this galaxy, and this is almost the raw data. I just did a little bit of cosmic ray rejection on this. I should mention this is work led by Mark Swingbank, who's at University of Durham, in collaboration with me, with Richard Bauer as part of Mark's thesis, also my student Joanna Smith, and many other people like Graham Smith and Richard Ellis as well. So a cast of thousands on this. So really, why are we obsessed with these rotation curves? I'll come on to that in a second. But this is, first of all, this is the data cube. I've tried to render it to using IDL to give you some idea. This is the HST image. You can see this is the lens dark. This is actually multicolour, so you can see areas of red light, areas of blue light. Again, at redshift 1, the same experiment Lexi and I were doing at redshift 4. Are there distinct regions of stellar populations? This is the IFU cube collapsed. So this is, you're seeing the spatial domain here. This is collapsing all the spectral resolution elements, and this are the same. And then this is taking a slice in the wavelength direction, showing that doublet, and showing as you go across the galaxy, you actually have a wavelength shift, therefore a velocity shift. So why would we want to do all this at redshift 1? Well, the key issue is that rotation curves of galaxies, of course, give you the encircled mass, the total mass, dark matter plus luminous matter baryons. And this has, of course, been well known since Newton, but an important discovery was by Brent Tully and Fisher, that in fact this is correlated with the brightness of the galaxy. So the brighter the galaxy, the larger this turnover velocity. So bright things are more massive. Maybe it's not such a revelation after all, but this Tully-Fisher relation has been one of the backbones of probing galaxy evolution for a long time. And the reason for that is that at a particular redshift, you know, there's a strong correlation between parent galaxy luminosity and its essentially dark matter mass or total mass. Okay, but this relationship might well change with redshift. Okay, if you can imagine a scenario at high redshift where you form your dark matter first and then pool gas and then slowly over a Hubble time turn all that gas into stars, then you have a strong evolution in the mass to light ratio. Whereas if at high redshift you have various mini halos and you form your stars first in those and through dry mergers merge them, then the mass to light ratio stays fairly constant. It does alter slightly because, of course, as time goes by, the main sequence turn off moves to increasingly lower mass stars, and you know, the galaxy gets redder and slightly less luminous, but it's less dramatic than this large evolution in mass to light ratio that one would expect in a scenario that you form the dark matter halos first and then populate them with stars later. So if you can measure the zero point of the Tully-Fisher relation as a function of redshift, you can actually perhaps learn something about galaxy evolution. So this has been around for a while. The literature is strewn with claim and counterclaim. Part of the problem is that these things at high redshift are small, are compact. If you're able to spread the starlight out, then you can have some hope that you're seeing a real rotation curve rather than just a velocity dispersion that could be due to a merger, some sort of interaction. If you're able to get spatially resolved spectroscopy and see a genuine rotation curve as opposed to some chaotic motion, then you can actually say, oh, that's probably a spiral galaxy, I can do some science with it. Of course, what comes to our help is gravitational lensing, which does exactly that. So here we have the original image of this, the HST, and this is applying the lens model and delensed, and perhaps that looks a little bit like a spiral. I think the killer thing is that we have a rotation curve for this galaxy. Sorry.
Inclination angle.
Inclination angle, yes? Yeah. So that comes from the lens model and the delens version. In fact, you know, the actual ratio of that is 2:1. Now, it does depend on the lens model, right? But
what are the errors like, I guess is what I'm asking.
Of the order of 10%. Yeah.
That could.
But it goes in a sine eye, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah. So, and here we have a velocity gradient, of course, red receding and sort of green approaching. And we have a nice velocity gradient compatible with a rotating spiral galaxy at redshift 1. Now, in Mark Swinbank's paper with, you know, cast of thousands, we actually attempted to put this on a Tully-Fisher relation. Now, bear in mind, this is one galaxy. Normally, to do a Tully-Fisher, you need at least 10, right? So take this. This plot does come with a health warning that you shouldn't read too much into it. But this one galaxy does appear to lie quite accurately on a quite modest evolution relative to the Tully-Fisher relation we see in galaxies today. There's a slight complication in that you notice the Tully-Fisher relation plots absolute magnitude versus rotation velocity, that is the turnover of the rotation curve. But this absolute magnitude, of course, it's critically dependent on what waveband you measure it in. Now, traditionally people have measured it in the B band, which I would argue is an appalling measure of baryonic mass because it's dominated by the young stellar population. You really want to do this in the I band or the infrared. Unfortunately, redshift 1, that gets harder. We do have some data in the infrared from the K band, and again in the infrared it does sit close to the relation. I'm showing here the rest frame B band version. Since we published this was 2003, we had another paper come out earlier this year where we'd expanded the sample to more like a dozen galaxies and found similar behaviour. Really what we'd like to do is many hundreds of galaxies at redshift 1 using this. This would rely on multiple deployable RFUs. Bear in mind, with an RFU typically hitting one galaxy at a time, and even the most generous time assignment committee get a bit bored after a while. If you're able to hit 20 or so in a field at once, that would be great. There's an instrument called KMOS, which is potentially being built for the VLT, the ESO telescopes, which will do just that. So that would be terrific. Now, in my last couple of minutes or so, I'll move on to a topic which I think probably will revisit and again involves Lexi Moustakas. This is the other half of our project. I talked about optical IFUs, GMOS, and now infrared IFUs, SURPASS. Of course, this gets you to slightly higher redshifts using the same emission line diagnostics, working at longer wavelengths. And this SURPASS was built by the Institute of Astronomy in Cambridge, partly with private money from the Sackler Foundation. This is the team that built it, including the PI Ian Parry and graduate student Andrew Dean, whose thesis was on building this. You can see as we were going up Cerro Pachon, we were dealing with some pretty steep gradients going up the mountain. And it works in the infrared. It's fiber-fed, like GMOS. Works between 1 micron and 1.8 microns. It essentially doubles the available range of GMOS. It has 490 fibers here, with a variable spatial scale. You can just put a different lens in front of it. You can use it with AO, very fine pixels, or use it with big pixels to map large regions of sky. It has a high resolving power. That's important because we're working in the infrared. We want to minimize the contamination of these skylines. So by running at resolving power, that's lambda over delta lambda of 4,000, you know, 90% of RRA is clean. Okay, and we're able to reach fairly faint limiting fluxes. This won't mean much to people, I guess, but in fact this is one solar mass per year in H alpha at redshift 1 also. We successfully demonstrated this on the Gemini South telescope. There's another zoom in of the field lens. What we're doing is these are the fibers. We're shining light the backside of the instrument, so light comes out the front just to make it a pretty photo. And it looks like there's gaps between the lenses. In fact, they're not. They're hexagonal, so there's a large filling factor. That's just an optical effect. And the instrument itself, SURPASS, of course, it's infrared. You want to keep it cool. And it sits away from the telescope. It sits on the floor of the dome in a large blue enclosure that looks like a bit like a cold meat storage unit. Strange that. It was one of the reasons why it was quite cheap to build. And within this, it's kept at minus 40. And then, of course, the electronics themselves are kept at liquid nitrogen temperature. We know this is minus 40 because it did break one night, and we sent a graduate student in to fix it, and he reported it was very cold here. You need to wear gloves when it's that cold here. Yeah. It's all right, we let him out after a few minutes. So I'll just, before I come on to the science we've done in the last couple of minutes, I'll show you a few first light photos. This is us very excitedly looking at the first data come off. This, in fact, was staged after we knew the instrument was working. And when we turned up at Gemini South in Chile, it had been pretty grim winter, and sort of had to dig our way out to Gemini South there. This is Andrew Dean and Ram Prakash. Well, yeah, that's right. But it's a very good point you make, and you know, it's not only being upside down in the southern hemisphere and having to compete with the snow. I mean, you know, there's lots of other things you have to really worry about in Chile. Yeah. So, what did we do lensing-wise with SURPASS? So this project was led by Ben Metcalf, who's now at Garching in Germany, involving Lexi Moustakas, myself, and Ian Parry, the instrument scientist. We thought we'd have a look at everyone's favourite Einstein cross, 2237. Now, this is obviously a strong lens, and most of what everything I've said until now is to do with the background galaxy, studying its properties. This project actually deals with the properties of the lens itself. Okay, so what we've done is used SURPASS, which is of course the integral field unit, to monitor simultaneously the light from all four images of this quasar. This is a lens quasar, redshift 1.7. It's lensed by a galaxy which is very nearby, redshift 0.04. I think the lowest redshift object I've ever observed, I think. There are far nicer pictures of this beautiful Einstein cross, but what this is our SURPASS image collapsed down, showing, you can just about see a couple of the knots there, galaxy in the middle, two fainter knots there. I'll show you more detailed data there. But even with ground-based resolution, we're able to spatially resolve the four different knots and the host galaxy. So this is one of the knots. By the knots, I mean the quasar images. And we see here H beta from the quasar. This is an atmospheric absorption line. And then this is extracting in the middle where the lensing galaxy is. So you can see that and that are entirely different spectra. This shape is to do with the response to the detector. That's taken out at a later stage. I'll show you that. But you see there's no evidence of H beta from the quasar, which is good. It shows that we have the spatial resolution that we can make sense of this, that we're not mixing in the light together. So what is the experiment? Well, the experiment is to look at the four quasar images at the same time in two different lines, the H beta line and the O3 line. So these probe different characteristic length spatial scales of the quasar. So the this comes from the narrow line region of the order of a kiloparsec or so in extent. Okay, the forbidden line, oxygen 3. H beta, of course, comes from an area which is much closer to the quasar, perhaps a few hundred astronomical units. Okay, so you have two different probes of characteristic length scales of the quasar itself. Right. Now, interestingly, of course, that gives you a leverage to explore possible clumping within the dark matter of the lensing galaxy, because if that dark matter clumping is matched to one of those length scales, you would expect, you know, images in the broad line H beta and images in the narrow line oxygen 3, the forbidden line, to have a different signature. This just emphasizes what I said before, that this is the H beta, this is the oxygen 3 line. And you can see just by eye these contour plots, the ratios are very different of the four quasar images. So here in the broad line region, A outshines everything else. Here, the brightest one, their more comparable brightness, is not D. So in fact, Ben and Lexi worked enormously hard simulating this, and I think probably Lexi will say a few words either later on at some point in the meeting on this, possibly. Maybe. But the simulations indicated that they could constrain substructure on this characteristic mass scale between 10,000 solar masses and 10 to the 8 solar masses to be of the order of 5% of the surface mass density, which is surprisingly high compared to some.
What's the same radius of these masses at that density?
It's... right, so the Einstein radius, well, the separation of these things is 2 arc seconds, is that right?
No, I mean of these substructures, because wouldn't the broad line radius be much, much smaller than the, let's say, the characteristic Einstein radius of these substructures? I mean, I'm surprised you can
yeah,
substructure
yeah.
with the kind of broad line region.
Right.
I mean, I would think more of Michael Lenz in this case.
Right, but I mean, 10 to the 8 is...
It's millilenses, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And what's the angular scale of the broad line region of the quasar?
10,000 times larger than the stellar Einstein radius that you get. I mean, it's literally microarc second versus milliarc second.
The broad line region.
So the broad line region is well matched in angular source size.
There's a number of things that can mess you up on this. One is quasar variability, of course. Mm-hmm. Yep. Which is why, you know, future instruments, long-term monitoring, such things would be important. Another one is microlensing by stars in the lens. In the paper we did look at some of the mid-infrared data to see whether that provided useful constraints, and it seems that this substructure thing, the error bars are somewhat large, but it does seem to be a genuine detection of substructure within the lens.
I mean, you're completely dominated by stellar mass in this particular system, right? I mean, there's even if you're looking along a column, right, the mass within the Einstein radius is effectively probably 95% or more stellar in this particular system, because you're looking in the inner part of the bulge of the nearby spiral galaxy.
Right.
So you're looking at a few percent, right? I mean, you're looking at 5% or maybe 5% dark matter. So you're claiming to measure.
No, I mean, I think it goes out to several kiloparsecs, right? Within the lens, right?
But is very low redshift.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
I mean, they can never tell us whether the substructure is dark or not. Mm. But the only thing they can, this kind of experiment maybe can tell one day, is that there is some sort of non-smooth component.
Well, I mean, if it's in the stellar component, you would see it in the light, right?
Mm. Well,
because it's 5% surface density, it should be 5%. It must light rate from this fluctuates. Mm.
Well, we can't result. the full experiment. With this, looking at different emission lines, the full experiment is supposed to, ideally you would also look at the continuum, because the continuum would be affected by microlensing very clearly, because that's from the accretion disk of the But the idea would be to compare broad line, narrow line, and continuum fluctuation all at the same time.
Yeah.
And so that is taken somewhat into account here, but this is pilot study.
So I guess I'll wrap up now. I know I've gone on for longer than I anticipated. I've shown, I hope, that not merely is studying the phenomenon of gravitational lensing as a probe of dark matter interesting, but using it to spatially amplify the flux from distant galaxies enables us to probe intrinsically faint galaxies. And also, the first case study was to spatially resolve stellar populations in a redshift 4 arc, and we showed that in fact this redshift 4 galaxy wasn't homogeneous, had a complicated star formation history, was spatially resolved, and then went on to talk about how using the critical lines of low redshift clusters, that we can look for the most distant objects yet through critical line mapping. Mentioned two techniques to do that. One is the photometric redshift technique, essentially the Lyman break technique, and the second one is to do blind long slit spectroscopy. I presented a very marginal candidate redshift 9.8 galaxy that we'll see whether it stands the test of time. If it does, it's the highest redshift object yet found, or this week at least. And then gone on to discuss how, again, the amplification, the stretching of galaxies means that we can actually measure rotation curves in galaxies beyond a redshift of 1 and measure the Tully-Fisher relation and the evolution in that, which is a critical diagnostic of galaxy evolution, tells us about the assembly of galaxies, whether it's subunits with preformed stars merging, or whether you assemble the dark matter halo first and then turn your gas into stars over a Hubble time. And finally, I talked for the first time about the properties of the lens itself, in this case a case study that we'd look for the signatures of dark matter clumping. And I hope I've convinced you that integral field spectroscopy, that's spectroscopy over a two-dimensional area, or 3D with the wavelength as well, is a new window on the universe. So thanks very much for listening.
Is anyone building image slicing IFUs?
Absolutely. OSIRIS?
ESI has one.
ESI has one?
Yes.
Yep.
And OSIRIS is a lens
level. And Symphony on VLT. I mean, there's benefits to image slices that you don't have to put your photons down bits of optic fiber,
right,
which is quite lossy.
Right.
One of the questions I have is, maybe it's something to be considered by the working groups, is if we compare the benefits of doing sort of a high Z galaxy redshift survey with or without gravitational telescopes, when do we win? Like things like systematic uncertainties, like uncertainty on the volume, magnification maps, to what extent do they limit searches for galaxies to gravitational telescopes? This would be something that maybe working groups.
I mean, at some level, it's the faint end slope.
Right.
So the question is, right, you magnify a bit of space, and you, of course, boost things into your flux sample, but then you lose volume because you're just expanding that volume. And it depends critically on what is the faint end slope of the galaxy luminosity function. Now, the science arguments are that you'd like to study faint galaxies anyway because it's the only way to get there. But then, as a blind search, are you actually better off not looking around clusters and doing blank sky?
Yeah, I mean, the question is, there's several sides to it, but one of the important ones is this problem of systematic effects that nobody ever considers, to my knowledge.
Yeah, that's very good.
If we don't know the volume to better than 30% ever, then why bother, you know, trying to do a luminosity function more precise than that? Mm.
Another question on the first part of the talk. I mean, last week, I don't know if you saw the tape, there was this claim of a redshift 7 galaxy.
Yeah.
And I think it had 9 alpha.
It did. It was a Japanese group, yeah. Yeah.
And so, I mean, how does this fit in with the fact that the optical depth from the quasars is shooting up, right, to 6.5, and you still see the line, which is not absorbed in the resonant wings of 9 alpha?
Yeah. Well, I think it's simply that you have your distant galaxy, and the worry is that in fact you have a soup of neutral hydrogen around it. So the photons, in a very simple, when you first turn on star formation, you produce some ionizing photons, but the photons don't get far because their mean free path is tiny. You surrounded it with neutral gas, so they just keep on resonance scattering until the Lyman alpha halo gets so diffuse it's unobservable, or they're mopped up by dust obscuration. But if you leave it long enough, you have an expanding Stromgen sphere, and the radius of this is essentially the in light years is the amount of time that you've turned on star formation from, because you will progressively ionize more and more. So the hope would be that eventually the size of this means that when the photons, which start off at Lyman alpha, say, by the time they hit this, they're at, you know, 12, 20 angstroms or something, and they're no longer resonant. That in fact the Hubble flow within this bubble means that by the time they get there, they can get out.
Does this fit in with Edwards' optical depth?
Yeah, because the optical depth is this bit.
Yeah, as long as the sphere is large enough.
Yeah.
You can get out of the wind.
Yeah, sure. But I was just wondering whether this works out statistically, whether
the AGM is not completely uniform, so some line of sights may be neutral earlier than
the rest. I mean, you're right to raise this as a point, and it's a very significant paper by a Japanese gentleman whose name I can't recall. A ratio of 6.96 galaxy found or published last week in Nature. And, you know, this gives us hope that beyond ratio 6.3, which is when the Gunn-Peterson kicks in, we can see Lyman Alpha.
Last question. When you did the 2237 stuff, did you get velocity dispersion of the bulge at all?
No. The data wasn't that good.
Okay. I had a question about the last one. If you take a nearby galaxy, in one of these massive simulations, so not actual galaxies, how much small-scale structure is there in the massive column volume behind it?
Oh, okay, so between the galaxy and this and quasar.
Yeah, I mean, that's 5% surface density. How much of that 5% is in the rest of space behind it?
The lensing biological structure and stuff.
There are a couple papers on it. There's at least one paper that claims that you could get all of it from the full line of sight.
And that's Batmanov, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there is Keaton.
Function Zhao, who should be coming to this thing too.
Yeah, and then it's Chen and Keaton who claim completely the opposite, right?
Yeah, so there's not agreement.
On average, I think you mean you're kept by the integrate without the galaxies above Omega. So 0.2, 0.3,
and cap out the galaxy is 1.
No,
but this is the smaller scale material, not the large scale.
Yeah, but assuming that all statistically averages out, right? So
well, the fluctuations as
right.
Right. So it could easily be all.
So I mean, along your, let's say, from 0 to infinity, you have lens, you have mass 1 in the lens and more than 20, maybe 23% in anything along the way.
So you're arguing that it could be
the galaxy. I mean, there could be a contribution of things along the line of sight, but you would always be going with the galaxy.
Plus, in addition, you lose, depending what redshift they are. If they're too close to the quasar, it's not good for you.
It would be the stuff closer to the lens.
This system is a little bit weird.
So things that like
the
three are actually going to be really important.
Right. Exactly.
Let's thank Andy.
Oh, yes, thank you.